The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
There are many out on the streets of Paris tonight, celebrating, happy, and relieved at the outcome.
Well, that's how they celebrate in France, apparently. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, and we're coming to you live from our studio here in Edstone, England. And that was some footage from France, where the radical left pulled out a surprise win of the election and took off and rioted anyway, because, well, it's France. And there's more to it than that as well, that we will talk about a bit later on. Quite a remarkable story. It feels like in the day of opinion polling, and the polls get them wrong, but especially, Britain's election, we knew several weeks ahead of time what to expect. Then you get an election like France that just kind of throws up something that we're not expecting at all in terms of polls and things like that. Well, welcome, like I said, to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, or Trumpet Daily Show, whether you're listening to us through our website, thetrumpet.com, through our Rumble channel, through the Live from America TV channel, or however it is you're tuning in over the air, the old-fashioned way. However it is, we are very grateful to have you. Mr. Stephen Flurry was just a bit congested after all of his travels and things, so he asked me to step in, I'll give you a bit of an update on that French election shortly. I also wanted to touch on some U.S. politics. It does apply to some of what I want to get into on the show today. We've put together, our team in the States put together a bit of a montage on Joe Biden's interview with George Stephanopoulos. That went out Friday evening. It's been fascinating to watch this story from the UK, where, I mean, if you've been paying any attention at all, it's been so obvious that Joe Biden has had some issues. He's not been all there for a long time. And the media tried to say, what was it that the French lady, we've started calling her that over here now as well. She said something about, it's a far right conspiracy, or deep fakes. That's it. Cheap fakes. It's all cheap fakery. It's been very clearly that's not true. But most in the UK, they've not really been paying attention. And they kind of suddenly wake up with this debate and all of the clips there, and saying, yeah, okay, this guy really isn't all there. I guess that there is more to this than cheap fakes. And now, then a lot of people were getting ready to watch this Stephanopoulos interview, thinking, okay, well, let's give him a second chance. Let's see how he does in that. And it was about the friendliest interview they could get. It wasn't live. They have time to edit it. Here's some highlights. This was the result of that interview.
Was this a bad episode or the sign of a more serious condition?
It was a bad episode.
In Camp David, why wasn't that enough rest time, enough recovery time?
Because I was sick. I was feeling terrible. Matter of fact, the docs with me, I asked if they did a COVID test because they were trying to figure out what was wrong. They did a test to see whether or not I had some infection, a virus. I didn't. They just had a really bad cold.
Did you ever watch the debate afterwards?
I don't think I did, no.
Well, what I want to get at is, what were you experiencing as you were going through the debate? Did you know how badly it was going?
Yeah, look, the whole way I prepared, nobody's fault but mine. I prepared what I usually would do, sitting down, as I did come back with foreign leaders or the National Security Council, for explicit detail. The fact of the matter is that what I looked at is that he also lied 28 times. The way the debate ran, not my fault, no one else's fault.
But it seemed like you were having trouble from the first question in, even before he spoke.
Well, I just had a bad night.
What's your plan to turn the campaign around?
You saw it today. How many people can you get and draw crowds like I drew today? You find me any more enthusiastic than today? Huh?
I mean, I don't think you want to play the crowd game. Donald Trump can draw big crowds. There's no question about that.
He can draw a big crowd, but what does he say? Who does he have? I'm the guy supposedly in trouble.
Can you serve effectively for the next 4 years?
George, I'm the guy that put NATO together, the future. No one thought I could expand it. I'm the guy that shut Putin down. No one thought it could happen. I'm the guy that put together the South Pacific Initiative with AUKUS. I'm the guy that got 50 nations, out, not only in Europe, outside of Europe as well, to help Ukraine. I'm the guy that got Japanese to expand their budget. For example.
Mr. President, I've never seen a president at 36% approval get reelected.
Well, I don't believe that's my approval rate. That's not what our polls show.
And if you stay in and Trump is elected and everything you're warning about comes to pass, how will you feel in January?
I feel as long as I gave it my all and I did the goodest job as I know I can do. That's what this is about. This is about.
As long as you do the goodest job that you know you can do. And if that was the goodest job that he could do under those pretty favorable circumstances, that's quite the indictment. What was that about? He put NATO together. Didn't go particularly well. And I think part of it is that George Stephanopoulos did. I mean, there were some tougher questions in there than I was expecting. Maybe this is more. It's been fascinating to see the media turn on a dime on this story and go from, you know, what are you talking about? It's a far right conspiracy theory that there are any health problems with Mr. Biden to going after him. And he was a little less friendly than I thought he would be, I guess. But the pressure continues on the Democrats to do something, to change something. I saw where he phoned in to Morning Joe this morning, which I didn't. I figured that's enough for Mr. Biden. You don't need to hear necessarily the Morning Joe conversation. But it was kind of about the same, where he's obviously got a script in front of him, but still struggles to get out the lines. But one new call caught my eye today. This is something, it was written actually a few days ago. It's by law professor John Banzhaf, I guess his name is. PJ Media had a piece on it over the weekend, which is why I thought it was worth mentioning. Basically, it's a brand new idea where they talked about having Joe Biden stay on the ticket, but having a new vice president. So he wrote that they should have Biden continue to run, but substitute Barack Obama as his running mate and candidate for vice president. So basically, this really educated law professor thinks he's found a way around the 22nd Amendment, the amendment that says that a president can only serve 2 terms. 8 years in office, effectively. And he writes, according to the overly precise language deliberately carefully chosen by the drafters, Obama cannot, quote, be elected to the office of the president, but there's nothing to say he cannot be elected to the office of the vice president and then succeed to the presidency if Biden becomes unable to perform his presidential duties or simply resigns. Now, I don't actually think that's going to happen. I think, this guy's a legal scholar. I'm not, but I mean, the 12th Amendment says no person constitutionally ineligible for the office of president shall be eligible to that of vice president of the United States. That to me seems like a pretty clear bar for Mr. Obama running as vice president. But it shows the hold that Barack Obama still has over the Democratic establishment, that you have some law professor coming along and trying to figure out some way, any way, somehow, that they can have Barack Obama come back. They really do miss him that much. There's still people in the establishment swooning over him. That's swooning over Barack Obama. That kind of statement is where they're saying, okay, well, if we technically he can't run for president, but he could run for vice president. And then if we declare Joe Biden incapacitated right after he's elected, then we have Barack Obama president again. Like I said, I don't really think that's going to happen, but that's how desperate they are there for to bring him back. I think there's something else that speaks to the long arm of Barack Obama, where this is Business Insider. Business Insider had this article after the UK election called How Obama Mentored the New UK Prime Minister to Help Him Tell Us His Story. So we have our new Prime Minister here in the United Kingdom, and he's had some pretty close contacts with Barack Obama, and certainly one particular member of his government, who's one of his now highest members of the cabinet, is, you know, went to Harvard Law School, very close to Barack Obama. So Sir Keir Starmer, he's now the British Prime Minister. After Labour won a landslide, they won 412 out of the 650 seats. And note, we had the result the next day. Britain was voting on Thursday. We had the result on Friday. That's how you do elections. That's the normal. You know, you have people, they count through the night. It's not that hard. In Britain, we get a lot of things wrong. Even we can turn around election results the day after. It's not that hard. And if it takes longer, there are some shenanigans going on. So we got those elections, but it's quite a remarkable election where he won 63% of the seats, so nearly two-thirds of the seats in the Houses of Parliament. But he won about a third of the popular vote. I think it was 33.8%. So he wins a third of the vote, but two-thirds of the seat. It's the smallest vote share for a winning party in post-war history, perhaps in all British history. And it actually, their vote went down. It was I think, around 800,000 fewer votes this election than they won in 2019 when they suffered a humiliating defeat. So they suffer a humiliating defeat in 2019. They lose votes and win by a landslide this time around. If you're into electoral systems nerds, I guess it's a fascinating result. But I think it does say something important about how quickly this could change and how quickly you could have a very different government. And, you know, it would just take another election. You'd have somebody very different in charge in Britain. So they're not particularly popular, but the Conservative Party lost. And we'll get to Barack Obama and his influence shortly. I just think it's worth looking at the bigger picture before we get there, where the Conservative Party went from 365 seats to 121. Absolute wipeout. Because what you have with the Conservative Party in Britain is, it's a Conservative Party. You know, it's kind of like the Republican Party was before Donald Trump came along, where it's a party full of people that are conservative in name only. It's Labour light, basically. And here in Britain, they've been in power for the last 13, 14 years. And yet, what have you, like, you look at Britain and you've got this radical, perverted homosexual agenda in schools. You've got mass migration, just record high number of immigrants changing the face of the country, record high illegal immigration. You've got woke policies being forced on businesses. All of this is happening. And then you get the Conservatives going into the elections, pointing to these things that are happening, saying these are bad things that are happening. We don't like them. But they've been in power for the last 14 years. And so a lot of their voters are pointing that and saying, yeah, you know, we agree with you when you say these were bad things, but how can we trust you to do anything about it when you've not done anything about it for the last decade and a half? And so you had a huge number of people leave them. They had about half the votes that they had last time around. So their vote gets cut in half, which enables Labour to come in and win this two-thirds majority. But I think the big news was that the Reform Party, Reform UK, they came in third place in the popular vote, winning 14%. Just an incredible turnaround for this kind of brand new party to come in third place. They initially only got four members of parliament. That was upgraded to five. Maybe I shouldn't have boasted on Britain quite as much in terms of getting the count done the next day. There are a few recounts. This was one particular place where, you know, if the margins are very close, if there's just a few hundred votes in it, they do a recount. They did a recount. They found actually Reform UK had won a fifth seat after they did that recount. So they've got five seats, which they beat the Liberal Democrats, or a left-wing party, a smaller left-wing party. Reform beat them, but the Liberal Democrats got 71 seats and Reform only got five, because the Liberal Democrats have a much longer, they've been going for decades. Their support is kind of much more concentrated in specific areas rather than being spread out throughout the whole country. But you know, Nigel Farage has tried to get into Parliament eight times and he's failed every time. So I think it is really remarkable that Reform managed to get five seats. It's easy to write that off and say, okay, it's just five seats. Like going into the election, I think it would be big news if Nigel Farage will be able to get a seat. And I think it will happen. If they get two seats, Reform will have done amazingly. Reform will have exceeded my expectations. They got five. I mean, for a brand new party, Nigel Farage has been trying since the 90s to get into Parliament and hasn't done it. So Reform have done incredibly well. There's a massive shift towards them that have enabled this to happen. But now we've got Sir Keir Starmer in charge. And I think this is where I wanted to talk about some of his ties to Barack Obama, because he's worked very hard to have a boring election campaign. I think it's kind of a selling point for Sir Keir Starmer that he's a boring leader. Because, I mean, you look at who you had last time. You had Boris Johnson, Sir Keir Starmer is trying to differentiate himself from. Boris Johnson is a very not boring leader. And then Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party that kind of led Labour to disaster, he's an out and out social, like he's kind of a Bernie Sanders type figure, who's a communist, who will tell you that he's a communist. He's not a communist pretending to be democratic or anything like that. He's pro Hamas, he's pro Hezbollah. He's pretty much overtly anti-Semitic. He's now been kicked out of the Labour Party. But again, Sir Keir Starmer wanted to be very boring and kind of technocratic, and he figured he can make it quite different, make himself seem quite different to Jeremy Corbyn. But there is indications that he has had radical views. I think he tried to kind of hide, really, or not really give much indication of what his views actually were in the election campaign. But back in 2005, he was on a video where he talked about, he'd become a Queen's Counselor. That's a type of lawyer. And he said, it's kind of funny that I've been a Queen Counselor, because I used to say I want to get rid of the Queen. I want to abolish the monarchy. That's quite a radical position in the UK. So he's kind of come in, though, more as, well, what does he really think is a bit of an unknown? Which is why I think this Business Insider article is very interesting, that talks about his ties to Barack Obama. And a lot of this article is actually based on a Politico podcast that they put together, that they did back in March. And they interviewed David Lammy. So David Lammy is now Britain's foreign secretary. He's probably one of my least favorite politicians over here. He's just an absolute race baiter. There's been a tweet from him that's been doing the rounds since he was appointed, back when, you know how they elect a pope, and I think if it's black smoke, they don't have a pope, and if it's white smoke, they do. And the BBC had some kind of headline about, is it going to be black or white smoke today? And David Lammy kind of jumps in there with, well, why are you bringing race into this? It had nothing to do with race, but he's a man that sees race everywhere. Everything is always about race. I think it took him until, I don't know whether he even managed to get through a sentence of his first speech as being appointed foreign minister before he started bringing up race. But anyway, this is from Politico's podcast back in March, where they talked to David Lammy and his connection, his relationship with Barack Obama.
So you've got close links to American politicians, particularly on the Democratic side. You dined with Barack Obama this week. Oh, how was that, by the way?
It's wonderful. Look, I've known President Obama now for two decades. He is erudite. His commitment, particularly to young people globally and leadership, I have huge respect for. And it was wonderful to see him in London again. And, you know, he's obviously still very much engaged. He met with Rishi Sunak. He met with Keir Starmer.
Did he give you any advice?
Well, he has already been speaking, obviously, to Keir Starmer. That's now pretty well documented. Obama's approach is always seated in authenticity. We have seen Keir Starmer talking a lot more about the role that his mother struggled terribly with illness for many, many years. His father cared for her, talking about his backstory much more comfortably than perhaps we saw a few years ago. And I know that Obama had strong views that Keir should do that. And I think also President Obama has been really...
So the inspiration, can I just pause on that and say, was the inspiration for those actually very much, as you say, more moving, sort of fuller accounts in a way that Keir Starmer has given of himself, based on that, the memoir of his father, that Barack Obama...
I think Barack Obama has been really clear on misinformation, disinformation, the challenge for politicians to communicate who they really are with a lot of noise. And he's one of the voices, he's not the only voice, but one of the voices that's encouraged that. And I think we've seen more of that in recent months.
Just very interesting to hear him talk about, well, Barack Obama, he's still very much involved. He's going around. I mean, this was back, I think they interviewed him shortly after Barack Obama came to the UK. He went to 10 Downing Street. He met with Rishi Sunak, who was the prime minister back then. He met with Sir Keir Starmer. He apparently had dinner with David Lammy. And he's saying, well, you know, he's very much involved. And I think, you know, this is very important. If you think back to the Russiagate scandal, so much of that was kind of done out of the UK, where to get around... You know, the American Constitution has, rightly so, it stops you from spying on your political opponents. There are things in there designed to stop you from weaponizing your intelligence service against a domestic political opponent. And Barack Obama got around those, very much so. But also, one other thing that he did was that he used the British intelligence service, because there aren't, you know, that's not covered by American constitutional protections. He called up people in Britain and said, hey, can you have GCHQ, the British listening post, do this and that? And can they spy, and, you know, and can MI5 do this? And it was a way of getting around the constitution. And now he's still got these close links. You've got an election campaign in America. He's coming over, meeting with Rishi Sunak. He's got these close links with this new government. And remember back in 2016 when he was doing all this, that was with a conservative government. And again, a conservative government, very much conservative in name only. But that was with, in theory, a right-wing government. Now this is a left-wing government that is going to be much more closely aligned to him ideologically. How is he going to work with them? What's he going to do there? So I think that's a reason why this is important to watch. I think it also shows how there's just a funny thing there that shows how much influence Barack Obama has over Sir Keir Starmer, where in the UK election campaign, it was kind of a running joke how much Sir Keir Starmer would bring up that his dad was a toolmaker. Like, it would come up every time, every speech, every debate. If there was an opportunity for him to drop in, oh yeah, my dad was a cool toolmaker, he would drop it in. And cartoonists, you know, everyone picked up on this, all the you know, the people that do spoofs and this kind of thing, and he was routinely mocked for this. But then you listen to that from David Lammy, and apparently it's Barack Obama that told him to do that, that told him to talk about your background more, talk about your emotions more, talk about where you're coming from more. And I guess he really took that to heart. Barack Obama told him to do this thing, and it's like every single conversation he is doing it. So he's really paying very close attention to what Barack Obama is telling him. Going back to this Business Insider article, it says Obama and Starmer's relationship is likely to continue if Starmer wins the election on Thursday, which of course they did. Obama has helped Starmer since at least 2021, when The Guardian reported they were involved in 2 hours worth of private talks with Lammy about how center-left parties could return to power. So David Lammy really is kind of this bridge to Barack Obama. I've got a little more about Lammy in my notes later on. I guess Keir Starmer himself, he was on this same Politico podcast back in September. He said Obama was the US president he spoke to most frequently. I've spoken to him a number of times, and his analysis on the world is always interesting, his challenges, and just going through with him and what he faced, how he rose to the challenges. It's always useful to test my ideas on people who won elections, people who've taken difficult decisions in power, because that helps me think how we might approach some of the decisions we might have to take if we do win that election. So, very much involved with Barack Obama. So that, I think, will be something very interesting to watch, the long arm of Barack Obama's politics and reach even into the UK. What is that going to mean for Britain? What's that going to mean? Is that an opportunity for him to use that against Donald Trump? We can watch that going forwards. It's also been interesting to look at who Keir Starmer's been putting into office, as well as David Lammy. One thing they've already announced is they're going to look at releasing thousands of prisons. The new prison minister talked about that. Sir Patrick Vaillance, you may remember him from the COVID shows. I don't know, Sam, if we can find a picture quickly of, I should have sent something over about Sir Patrick Vaillance, where he's one of those people that back in the days when, I think before we were kicked off YouTube for misinformation about COVID and things like that, we'd have his picture and his press conference quite up on the Trumpet Daily a fair bit, because he was one of the big people out there talking about, well, you've got a lockdown and you've got to do all of these things, and presenting the, there we go, you've got him up on the screen now, and he may look familiar, but he'd be up there with all the different spreadsheets and the graph showing that if we don't lock down yesterday, 2 million grannies are going to die and all of those things. He's now in government. So Keir Starmer brought him in. He's the science minister now. So that, I think, gives you a good flavor of the type of person that Sir Keir Starmer is bringing with him into government. Another interesting chap, Richard Hermer, he's in as the Attorney General. That's something that caught quite a lot of people by surprise, because he wasn't kind of in the shadow cabinet, in the group of people that ahead of the election, Keir Starmer had kind of indicated would be brought into government. He co-authored a chapter in a book called Corporate Complicity in Israel's Occupation. So he's kind of into this boycott divestment movement. He wants to boycott Israel. He has pushed for the International Court of Justice to investigate Israel for being a, quote, apartheid state. He's also repeatedly represented Gerry Adams, this Irish Republican Army terrorist. So he's quite an extreme person that has been brought in as the government's top legal advisor. And then, like I said, David Lammy, he described Donald Trump as a woman-hating, neo-Nazi sympathizing sociopath and a profound threat to the international order. So if Barack Obama rings up David Lammy and says, hey, can you have Britain's intelligence services, because the foreign ones at least will report to the foreign secretary, hey, can you have them do this? Can you have them spy on the Trump campaign? Or, you know, he's going to get a sure, no problem from David Lammy. He's attacked talked about the pro-Brexit wing of the Conservative Party. And he says that comparisons between the Nazis and people that are pro-Brexit have not been made strongly enough. So if you're pro-Brexit, he says you're a Nazi. He said, I will take the responsibility of being the first foreign secretary descended from the slave trade incredibly seriously. So he talks about, he's kind of big on slavery. Britain should pay reparations for slavery, apologize for legacy of slavery. He doesn't talk about the British Navy's legacy of defeating slavery, of freeing slaves worldwide, of telling nations, hey, you want to enslave people? Well, that means war with the most powerful navy on the planet. He's not talked about that. He became, in the 1990s, he was the first black Briton to attend Harvard Law School. And he attended that. Then it was at an event for black alumni where he, I think, first met Barack Obama. His wife, Nicola Green, is an artist who's drawn portraits of Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. So, again, very much in that relationship. I also thought it was interesting, he had his first visit this week. His first overseas visit was to Germany. A key priority for Sir Keir Starmer is to bring Britain closer to the EU. Basically, they want to get Britain as close as they can to EU membership. And they know who runs Europe. So he's right off to Germany, within days of being, you know, the first weekend of being elected, being put into office, off he goes to Germany. And he said he vowed to reset relations with Europe as a reliable partner, a dependable ally, and a good neighbor. So he was meeting with the German foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock. And basically, they want to do everything they can. They have ruled out rejoining the EU. That lost Labour a lot of votes when they tried to do that a time or two, when they kind of ran on a rejoining platform. So they have said, we're not going to rejoin. But they're basically pursuing as close as they can get. And probably it will be, they want to create a Brexit in name only and bring Britain back completely under European domination. And they know the EU is dominated by Germany. That's where they go first. They want to go and talk to Germany about this. So really, they're working to bring Britain back under German domination as part of the European Union. That's what they're working to do here. And I think if you look at what else we see, we're going to see much higher taxes. Of course, it's always like this in elections where they focus on the spending. We want to spend on this. They don't talk about where they're going to get the money from, but it will mean a lot more taxes. It will mean they're probably going to focus on things like mansion taxes, things that can get close to wealth taxes. They've already talked about putting a 20% tax basically on people that send their kids to private schools. There'll be a private school fee tax, or extending VAT or sales tax to private schools. Probably taxes on pensions if you have a certain amount of wealth, or taxes if you sell assets, much more taxes on capital gains, that kind of thing. They're talking about equal race pay laws, which, I mean, it is already illegal to discriminate in pay and to say, well, I'm paying you less because of your race. That's already illegal. But this is one of their big flagship projects, is to bring about a law that they say will outlaw this, which clearly, if that's already illegal, that's not what the law will do. And probably it'll be something where if you appoint a white man to a job, you will then have to fill in dozens of forms explaining why you didn't give that job to a black person or a woman or a transgender person, something like that. So they're going to make it much harder to hire white men in particular, and a heavy layer of red tape they'll have if you do try to promote white men, say. So there'll be a lot of that kind of thing coming into the UK. I mean, already there's so much pressure on, say, boards and businesses. You've got this kind of situation where, especially, say, in tech or in finance, the people at the top are mostly men because women haven't wanted to pursue those careers. But there are kind of quotas and things like that coming down from governments and industry bodies, so that they're just desperate for any kind of woman that they can give board level positions to. You'll see that dramatically take off very soon. But perhaps the success of Reform UK, that, like I said, it's, I think that's way bigger, their success, than it's easy to say, okay, they've got 5 seats and a 600 strong parliament. That's not particularly impressive. Breaking through into parliament at all is very impressive. But the fact that they've done that, perhaps that indicates that their time in office could be short-lived, and this left-wing drift could be short-lived. And the Conservatives are now pretty desperate after the election. Could you see a deal with Reform? They're having, the Conservative Party, they're now having their election, the Rishi Sunak, he's stepping down as Conservative leader, as you would have to after such an incredible defeat. And they're just kind of like, the situation at the moment is they feel like, well, we're not even ready to pick our next leader yet. We need to put an interim leader in power so that we can do more soul searching and talk about how do we turn around? What have we done wrong as a party before we then move on to a leader after that? And the idea of a conservative reform merger is not that far-fetched. And you could see them potentially being in an election winning position pretty quickly. This is what Eurointelligence wrote a couple of weeks ago. This is Wolfgang Munschau. He used to write for the Financial Times. So this is kind of a voice of mainstream opinion, very much establishment. This is not at all fringe, and they're pretty anti-Brexit. You know, this is not a kind of pro-Brexit cheerleading stance either. They says the scenario where Nigel Farage merges with the Tories after the election appears entirely realistic. Farage is the Tories, that's the Conservatives, Tories nickname for them, the Tories' best chance to regain power after 5 years. And the Tories are Farage's only route back into power. When the Conservatives were kicked out in 1997, it took them 13 years and four leaders until they were back in number 10 Downing Street. The promise of Farage is that he might short-circuit that. So Nigel Farage maybe could bring them, could end up as the next Conservative leader or down the line as a Conservative leader. And we forecast that Donald Trump will return to the presidency in the United States. And so I think that's why this is fascinating and important to watch in Britain. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had an article, Britain and Judah's government falls, America next. And I think that's a great place to go to understand what's happening around the world, in Britain, in Judah, Israel, in the Middle East, in the United States. The news in that is a bit out of date. You know, it's right after, I think, Boris Johnson was out as prime minister or back as, you know, one of the many bits of drama we've had here in the UK. But most of that article is analysis and prophecy, that it understand information about your Bible that is just absolutely spot on and feels bang up to date, despite being written, I'm just looking on the screen, 2 years ago. But in that article, he goes through, he talks about how, well, to understand Bible prophecy, you have to understand that Britain and America and the United States, they're descended from Ephraim and Manasseh, two biblical tribes of Israel. The Jews are descended from the tribe of Judah. And that Bible prophecy tells us the United States will experience a revival, and then that they'll use this to help Israel in the Middle East. And in that article, Mr. Flurry writes, it appears Mr. Trump may have to recover some of Judah's freedom for God's work to even be able to deliver God's message to the cities of Judah. Once this message goes out during the time of the end time Jeroboam, God says, I will not pass by them anymore. God passes by the last time to show three end time nations of Israel, the United States, Britain, and the Jewish nation, how to solve their problems and to warn them of the consequences of their failure to do so. 2 Kings 14:28 tells us Donald Trump comes back and it affects politics in both America and Judah to enable that message to go out. Things get better in both these nations for a time. Could the same thing happen in the UK? 2 Kings 14:28 does not specifically mention Ephraim, the United Kingdom in Bible prophecy, that is, but it is still part of Israel, and God still has a powerful message to get to them. These three countries all fall together, but this verse also indicates that God gives all three countries a reprieve from that fall, allowing his message to go out one more time. The change in politics in Britain and Israel could show we're close to this prophecy being fulfilled. So, as Mr. Flurry brings out, there's some, you know, we can't maybe be entirely sure of exactly how this applies to Britain, but certainly the indication is there that if you've got Donald Trump coming back in the United States and there's a turnaround in Judah, could there be a turnaround in Israel too? Could you have something where there's a catastrophe, Britain has a snap election, the Conservative parties decide, well, we'll get behind Nigel Farage? I mean, the idea of a Prime Minister Nigel Farage, I think, has seemed pretty far-fetched for the last 5-10 years and more. It seems less far-fetched now after the scale of the Conservative defeat. Could you have something like that? And he obviously is very close to Donald Trump. And there's been kind of, he was over spending, I think, time with Donald Trump even before coming back to run for Parliament. So could you have a similar turnaround there? Well, I think Mr. Flurry's article just gives you a lot of food for thought. Britain and Judah's government falls, America next. And that's a great resource to look at to get a bit more on this. Well, I spent more time talking about that than I intended. I wanted to talk about two more elections. Lots of big elections recently. Let's move on. Let's talk about Iran, where on the surface, there's some good news from the Iranian election. A moderate has been successful. We've got a clip from the mainstream media in the United States informing you about the results of the Iranian election, if we can play that for you now.
The world is closely watching President-elect Masoud Pezeshkian to see if he will bring Iran out of increasing international isolation.
Mr. Pezeshkian, when he ran, was supported, interestingly enough, by some of the former government officials who had negotiated the Iran nuclear deal in 2015.
How much of a surprise was this that the mechanics, the political mechanics of Iran allowed a reformist to be elected?
Every single candidate had to be vetted by the so-called Guardian Council. One of the key elements that he's talked about is looking to engage once more again with the West. Many less hawkish parts of the administration are looking to perhaps re-engage with talks with Iran. But
Pezeshkian was the only moderate candidate allowed to run.
And one of the things, of course, that he wants is better relations with countries in the region and better relations with the West as well. And the president in Iran does have a considerable amount of power. But of course, all of that power rests within the system of the Islamic Republic, where, of course, anything that happens there needs to be signed off on by the supreme leader and, of course, by the strong military entities like, for instance, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as well, Eleni.
Masoud Pezeshkian has been promising that he's going to open up Iran to the world, renegotiate a nuclear deal with the Western countries.
He wants to soften the regime's edges, improving relations with the West so that it drops damaging economic sanctions.
The new president is coming in and he's saying we need a new, fresh pair of eyes, and perhaps we look forward to opening a new wave of discussions with the West. With the West.
Well, that was how this new Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, I didn't practice that enough in the run-up, but a tricky name to say. He has he's now in office. He's replaced the previous Iranian president whose helicopter crashed, and Western media is rejoicing, as you heard there. We've got a moderate and a reformer. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I think it's worth pointing out. We've heard this before, that this is exactly the kind of story that you got from Barack Obama and Ben Rhodes. If you remember Ben Rhodes, his novelist turned speechwriter, this was how they sold the Iran deal. The New York Times back in 2016 had this whole feature talking about how this whole narrative of moderates coming to power in Iran, enabling a deal, was, quote, largely manufactured for the purpose of selling the deal. So they made up this kind of story back then. They really focused on and exaggerated, well, we've got a moderate, we've got a reformer in power in Iran, and they're changing, so we can do this deal with them. I think we can expect something similar potentially now, that, okay, we've got a moderate in Iran, they're changing, and we're going to, we can do more deals with Iran. We can give them more money. We can give them, help them have nuclear weapons. We can do more on this. But that's not really the case. I like this quote. I've got it somewhere in my notes. I'm trying to skip through a bunch of stuff. Oh, here we go. So the new leader, he says he wants to try and have friendly relations with all countries except Israel. So, you know, a nice chap there, quite clearly. So, well, we still hate the Jews, but yes, we want friendly relations with everyone else. That is what this new Iranian president says. So, you know, Iran has not fundamentally changed. All the power really rests with that supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and this new leader doesn't really change that. It's a new face. There's a bit of a new. It might appear a bit different, but Iran hasn't fundamentally changed. They just changed how they want to appear to the world. All right, I wanted to make sure I had some time to talk about the elections in France. All Europe was really focused on what was going on with the French elections. These were a really big deal, and the result turned out very different to what everyone thought. And I think these elections are a crisis and an opportunity for Germany. And I think we could see some quite dramatic changes coming from them. Before we get into this, let me just read you a quote. We had a cover article in May, June of our Trumpet print edition, France's Deadly Ignorance About Germany. And here's how Mr. Fleury concluded that cover article. He said, "We need to watch Europe, watch France, and watch Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, because all these prophecies are about to be fulfilled. We must study them, recognize what is happening, and learn how we can receive God's protection. Because God is about to use this empire to punish America, Britain, and the Jewish nation to break their rebellion against him. He will then break the German-led war machine so all people of all nationalities can live peaceably under his rule." And Mr. Fleury is writing, watch France. And I think we've had some dramatic events already happening in France. after him saying that, and they're worth paying close attention to. So you had the so-called far-right National Front won first place in the first round of French voting. That was the headline a couple of weeks ago. That was what we were all focused on. And the big question was, going into the second round, would they win the second round? France has this complicated two-round system. If you don't win more, if you win more than 50% of the votes, that's it. You get your seat in parliament. If you win less than 50% of the vote, you're facing off in a second round against others that did very well. So France won the first round, but that only gave them a few seats in parliament. Most of them went through to have a runoff election, a second round of the election. And so, okay, they were overwhelmingly in first place in the first round. But then what happened is, in the second round, all the other parties voted tactically. So the mainstream right withdrew if the left candidate was in the best position to beat the National Front, and vice versa. And it worked. The National Front was beaten into third place. Now, I want to emphasize, this is far from a major defeat for National Rally or National Front. They used to be called National Front. They changed the name. They won 143 seats in the 557-seat parliament. That was a lot worse than people said they would do. But it's a massive improvement over the 89 seats that they had before the election. So they still beat seat. And for National Front and for all of these parties, the real prize is the presidency in 2027. And National Front, I think, are very well positioned to do very well in that race. So I don't think they're going to be super disappointed, but they're defeated. But really, at what cost? And the cost is that the new Popular Front won first place. This is an alliance of left-wing parties that was very hurriedly cobbled together because Macron announced his election at the last minute. And their leader, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, he's pretty much an out-and-out communist. Like, he is to the left of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, really. Very, very left. Like, one time when he was running, this time it was kind of a cobbled together coalition, but there's one time he was running, he wanted a salary cap at 400,000 euros per year. So if you earn more than that, a 100% tax rate, government takes all of the money extra. You know, that's the kind of chap that we're looking at. He is pretty anti-Israel, he's pro-Putin, and he came in first place. That's the guy that now he's out there saying, well, I want France to be run my way. I won the election. And this is storing up a couple of different crises for France. I think that you're storing up a migration crisis and an Islam crisis. You have a crazy situation in the French elections here where the National Rally, they used to be the National Front. Their leader is Marine Le Pen. Her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, ran the National Front. And he was kind of out and out anti-Semitic. In 1987, he was famous for saying, I'm not saying the gas chambers didn't exist. I haven't seen them myself. I haven't particularly studied the question, but I believe it's just a detail in the history of World War II. You know, it's not really important if 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. Maybe it's true, maybe it isn't. Doesn't really matter to me. That was his stance. So pretty unpleasant person. He was known as being anti-Semitic. Marine Le Pen has tried to change the party, rename the party, shift it away from that. But still, it was largely shunned. But now, actually, a lot of Jews said, actually, we're backing Marine Le Pen. We're going to back National Rally. Because despite all that baggage, they're better than Mélenchon and his party, France Insouciance or something like that was leading the new Popular Front, where he's got this tight relation. He said that radical Islam remains residual. It's not a problem. You know, in France, there was a French teenager who was raped, an attack. You know, she was raped because she was a Jew, and you had some teens that just wanted to go out and rape a Jew. You've got 1,600 anti-Semitic incidences in 2023, mostly after October 7th. Anti-Semitism is exploding, and he is not at all concerned. Mélenchon, in his victory speech, said he wanted to recognize a Palestinian state. He said, okay, I've won the election. That's what we need to do. So a lot of people have been shocked by Mélenchon. They say, actually, we should vote for the National Rally. So you're going to have, he's not going to stand up to Islam. He's not going to stand up to the migration crisis in Europe. So this is going to get much worse within France. You're going to have a much more of a Muslim country in France. Also, this is a major economic headache for France and therefore Germany, because this national, Mélenchon wants to spend like there's no tomorrow. He wants to bring the pension age much lower. France has a massive budget problem. It's at $3.2 trillion in debt, 110% of the size of its economy. The European Central Bank has put them in, they're breaching the EU's budget rules. And they've got an economic crisis coming. And that's an economic crisis for all of Europe, because they can't afford to bail out France at all. Like, France's economy is far bigger than any other problem that you've had with the Eurozone since then. So you've got that. And then Mélenchon's position is that, he wants to just steal the money to solve this problem. So about a decade ago, he wrote a book. It's called Bismarck's Herring. And he wrote in that book, the German Empire is back. So he is very against Germany. She says, Germany has become a danger to her neighbors and partners. I denounce her arrogance, her so-called model imposed for her profit alone. A monster is born across the Rhine. And his solution was basically a holdup to tell Germany, you've got to approve the European Central Bank giving us 100 billion euros. And if you don't, we're going to print it ourselves. Which, he's spot on about saying the German Empire is back and talking about Germany taking over Europe. Yeah, that he was writing that in the height of the euro crisis. And he was absolutely right in drawing attention to that. But his solution is basically, well, let's rob all the money from German savers. That's what printing 100 billion euros does. So you've got a bit of a crisis for Germany here, where the Islam crisis, the migration crisis is going to get worse, the economic crisis is going to get worse, and you've got potentially a government that's hostile to Germany, ready to come in there and exploit that. But also, I think it's a bit of an opportunity, because Mélenchon is nowhere near power, really. I mean, okay, he's going to have some influence, but he doesn't have anywhere near enough votes to get a majority. No one does. Politico, governing France will be hellish now, they wrote. The Spectator, France will probably be ungovernable for some time to come. France is now confronted by paralysis and institutional crisis. France has had 16 constitutions since 1789. Jean-Luc Mélenchon and this La France Insoumise have been calling for a sixth republic for years. That moment might now be approaching. So the French government, there's kind of this crisis for Germany, but also now France can't do anything. Their government is just paralyzed at home. And this, I think you could easily see how Emmanuel Macron could get behind a Germany that, as long as they keep him in power, becomes stronger. Make sure that France doesn't just start printing money or any of these things. Make sure France doesn't keep borrowing money like there's no tomorrow. He's already shown that he's willing to empower Germany if he suits its interests. So with France paralyzed and then this anti-German crusader in Mélenchon waiting in the wings, Germany may decide, well, now's the time that they've got to step up and cement their dominance of Europe. I'll just conclude with this quote. This is all the way back in 2008, at the start of this financial crisis that is still rattling on, where Mr. Fleury wrote, the crisis in Greece is a forerunner of a whole rash of similar crises set soon to break out across Europe. They will provide the catalyst for the EU's leading nation, Germany, to rise to the fore with solutions of its own making. Biblical prophecy declares that the result will be a European superstate with Germany at the helm, and that is not good news for America, Britain, and the little nation called Israel. And so I think in France, we could be soon to see another act in that crisis. So watch what is happening in France. I point you back as well to that article, France's Deadly Ignorance About Germany. Just some great material in there. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. If you have a hard time finding any of that material, if you have any questions or comments, you can email us at td@thetrumpet.com. You can call us at 1-866-930-3024. It's been great to have you with us today. And hopefully we'll have Mr. Stephen Flurry back in tip-top condition to give you all the news and Bible prophecy in the news tomorrow.